Hi, everybody. I'm Mary R., and I am an alcoholic.
Amen.
I'm very grateful to be here tonight, and I want to thank Milton and Arlene and the board for asking me to do this. I was taught that whenever I was asked to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous, to be grateful, and it is a privilege to speak here tonight. My sobriety date is August 15, 2005. My home group is the Unity Group in Memphis, Tennessee. We meet there on Monday and Thursday nights at 8 o'clock, and we meet on Fridays at noon. So if you're ever in Memphis, please come to the Church of Christ on Park Avenue to the big gymnasium in the back, and you're going to be in for a treat, because our group does base our meetings on the literature, and I love our literature. So with all that said, I know my job here tonight is to tell you what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And with God's help, I will do that. I am the oldest of three children. I have two younger brothers. I'm 14 years older than one and 18 years older than the other. Now, I basically grew up as an only child. And my life was good. I tell you, after the first 7 years, I do remember that I was always full of fear. My mother, when I was at the age of seven, had a heart attack. And she disappeared for a month, and I didn't know what had happened to her. I thought she had died, and nobody was telling me anything. And I was always so afraid. But as it turned out, she was getting better, and my father was going there every day to see her, and finally my grandmother, he just dropped me at my grandmother's house and left me, and one day she saw me crying. I was sitting at her vanity table, you know, those mirrors and dressers where you had all the jewelry and the makeup, and she used to let me sit there and play, and one day she saw me crying, and I told her what I thought, and she was like, "Honey, your mother's not dead. She's coming home soon." And so my father came and got me that day and took me to see her. And it was at that moment that I prayed and asked God to give me brothers and sisters, because I didn't want to be alone in this world. I had lots of cousins, and they all had 4 and 5 and 6 brothers and sisters, and they wanted what I had. We never want what we have, you know. Grew up basically with those cousins. I went to a two-room school. On one room, it was grades 1 through 4. And on the other side, it was grades 4 through 8. I mean, 5 through 8. And in the sixth grade, I was taken from that school. My father decided that the farm life, we lived on a farm. We were sharecroppers. My father worked very hard, and so did my mother, and so did I. I mean, I remember at the age of 5 having one of those old flour sacks that they made into a cotton sack, and I was running up and down the fields picking cotton with my mom and dad. And I mean, I did all kinds of farm work growing up, and I loved being in the back fields riding the tractor with my father. I used to go hunting. I mean, I was a real tomboy, and I had a good life. But when we moved to the city, all that changed. Suddenly, I realized that I was different from everybody else. See, they didn't wear homemade dresses, okay? Their mothers didn't press and braid their hair. They went to the hairdresser. They wore store-bought clothes. And so all of a sudden, my little pretty dresses, to me, became very ugly. I wanted to be like them. So, you know, I felt like people were, well, they were making fun of me. And it was not a nice feeling. And I became an introvert. I lived in fantasy world, in books. I read a lot. I was very smart in school. And I found an outlet through basketball. But I want to go back, because I want to let you know that during the time that I lived on that farm, when my father and my mother were sharecropping, the boss's daughter, she was the same age as I was, and we became very good friends. We visited each other. She would come and stay with me and sleep in my bed, and I would go to her home and sleep in her bed. And I knew our homes were different, but I just didn't feel that I was any less than. So keep that in mind now. So I found an outlet by playing basketball. I went to an all-black school. We were very good. We were winning championships. And during all this time, integration was coming about. You know, and I prayed that I was going to be a graduate in 1970. And I was going to graduate with honors if I could just maintain and stay at the school. And I prayed that I stay at the school. And in 1967, I had a brother now. I prayed for some siblings. And in 1967, my first brother was born. I was 14 years old, and I loved him. I did. I loved him. I thought they were, God answered my prayers a little late, and I thought my parents were a little too old to have children, but it was okay. And anyway, his name is Johnny, and I love him, and he loves me. So in 1968, they integrated our schools, and I had to leave the school and go across town and go to this huge school. And I ran into my friend that I grew up on the farm with, and I knew that I was going to be okay, that I had a friend. Well, my friend said, nope, it's not so. We're going to have to stick together, and it's going to be this way. And on the first day of school, I saw her, and I was so glad to see her. And she turned her back on me, y'all. She didn't know me. She didn't want to know me. She didn't want her friends to know that she knew me. And I was crushed. And I had my friends in the background laughing at me. So we told you so. So I did go on to graduate from that school. And the whole time I was there, I did not speak to her. We did not talk. We had no friendship, no association whatsoever. Now, mind you, other kids that I was in school with, some were drinking, and they were doing other stuff that I didn't participate in. I loved sports, and I was smart, and I did not graduate with honors like I wanted to, but I did graduate in the top 10% of my class. And I got scholarships for the University of Tennessee at Martin, and I went there, and I had cousins who had gone on to school before me, and none of them graduated, and I was going to be the first. I'm going to an all-white school, and I'm going to graduate with honors. And it's going to be different this time. College is going to be different from high school, because see, I know what to do now. Yeah. Well, I get there, and I meet this guy my first year. And I remember getting sick. I'm a young country girl, and I'm naive, and I don't know what's going on. But I go to a campus doctor. He said, don't worry. We're going to take care of you. You just got a little virus. And we're going to take care of it. And you're going to be able to graduate and still make your family proud. So the virus was taken care of. And, you know, I never told anybody about that virus until I got to AA. Because for years I thought I was punished because of that virus. After graduating college, I got married. And I wanted children. And, you know, I got pregnant twice, and I lost those babies. And I thought God was punishing me because of that virus I had in college. Now, I hope you understand what I'm talking about. Anyway, you know, I had somehow, I want to back up because I don't want to forget my brother Terry. I graduated high school in 1970, and I was a freshman in college. In 1971, I was 18 years old, and I had another brother born. And I was a freshman in high school when Johnny was born, and I was a freshman in college when Terry was born, and a sophomore in college. I get a virus, and I come home for a while. Well, would you know, I'm in the store one day, and I got Terry. And there was this nice young lady walked up to me, and she said, "Honey, your son looks just like you." And I go, "He's not my son. This is my brother." And she goes, "Oh, everybody knows that's your baby." And well, my mother happens to walk up right behind, and she said, "Well, I have, you know, I carried him for 9 months. That's my baby." And so, you know, even that thing that I didn't want people to talk about and accuse me of, you know, there I was. I got a young brother, and he's mine. So after getting married and losing babies, I remembered being in the church all my life. Every time we looked up, we were in church. Every Mondays for choir, for Wednesday, for Sunday school, Ursa, you name it. And all day on Sundays. And I vowed when I got to college I wasn't going to church. When I get grown, I'm not going to church. And they were practicing, pointing at me all the time. If you're not good all the time, God is going to punish you. You're going to die and go to Hades and burn forever. And so because of that virus, I thought that's what God was doing. Why would he let me get pregnant, get married, get pregnant, and not have these babies? So here I am, 24 years old, and I never had a drink. I need a drink. I need a drink. How else am I going to deal with this? So I'm working with my husband, and I both have very decent jobs. I'm working with the city of Memphis. He's working for the state. We have a nice home. We have nice cars. And we're only 20. I'm 24 and he's 26. And, you know, young black couple, we got everything in the world. We got it going on. And it's just going to get better. We're both being promoted all the time, getting great raises. And something, you know, and I didn't realize this until I got to AA, that in the process of losing those babies, I started to change. Something happened to me. I thought my husband was just not a good husband. He started going outside the home. And I thought it was because he looked at me as being less of a woman because I couldn't carry his babies. But I know the day that I had a part in all of that, because I did start to neglect him. It was all about me. Poor me and my babies. And the more he was away from the home, the more I wanted him to be, because the more I could drink. And as time went on, drinking was not enough. We were still doing well. I would go from a starter house to a bigger house. It's a nice sports car. Nice family car, but there was no family to put in it. There were no kids, and things just started to get worse. So I started to, and I truly respect that this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in singleness of purpose. But there was some solid alcohol that I started to use. And it really took a toll on my life and my relationship with the people around me. And this went on for years, and it wasn't getting any better, so I decided to take a geographical cure. I ran from Memphis to Florida, and I left my husband. And I was there for 8 years, and in the process of being there, he was in and out of the city. You know, I sent the divorce papers home, and he brought them to me in Jacksonville, and he never left. He would come back to Memphis and stay a while, and he'd come back to Jacksonville. And this went on for 8 years. And in the process, drugs came back into my life about 3 years after moving to Jacksonville. For the last 5 years, we did drugs there. And of course, drinking had never left. Drinking was always a part of everything. And so after that, I decided, okay, I've had enough. I'm coming back home. And I moved. I was telling someone that I left home at age 17, and I moved back in with my family, my parents, at age 45, you know. And things got worse. My parents were my biggest enablers, and, you know, I did this for another 5 years until my mother died. And when she died, my father took very ill, and I had a sick father on my hand, and I'm at the bottom of my addiction. Alcoholism was running rapid in our family because my younger brother, Terry, was just as bad as me. And we were losing everything that our families have worked hard for. And here's a girl that said she would never, ever put her mother or her father in a treatment center, into a nursing home. That's what I found myself doing because I had lost his home. I had remortgaged his home and I couldn't pay for it. I used that money to party with, because I was trying to drown out the pain of losing my mother. I didn't like God very much at all. He had taken my mother from me. She was my best friend, the only person that I thought loved me, and she was gone. And here I am stuck with all this stuff, and I don't know what to do. So I've lost the home, and I had no choice. And I put my father in a nursing home, and I had power of attorney, and my brothers couldn't tell me anything. And for 2 years, I was pretty much homeless. And one day, you know, our book talks about those sordid places that we go to. Now, on 151, that page, I understand that page. Because when I started to drink, it was for companionship, for friends, conviviality, all of that good stuff. And then all of a sudden it was gone. And I kept trying to recapture it, but I couldn't. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. And then one day I found myself in one of those sordid places doing things that a good girl like me shouldn't be doing. And I didn't know how to stop. And one morning I cried out and said, God, please help me. This is not the way it is supposed to be. I need you. If you are there, you need to help me. And guys, I went to sleep. First time I just gone to sleep. I usually pass out, come to, and start doing the same stuff all over again. But this morning, that particular morning, I woke up and I felt refreshed. I wanted to take a bath and put on clean clothes. And I went out onto the porch of this house that I was at. And they had a swing. And I remember sitting there. And the sky was so pretty. And it was so blue. And it was so sunny that morning. And I understood what Bill Wilson said when he talked about scales of pride falling from his eyes. And a new world had come into view. See, I saw a different world that day. That was my first spiritual experience. And this lady came out and said, don't you want something to drink this morning? Because see, I get up every morning begging for money to go get something to drink. And that morning, I did not. And you know, the cool thing was, my brother Johnny pulled up. I hadn't seen him in a year. And he pulled up and said, come go with me. And I want to tell you guys, that started my journey to treatment, a place that I said I would never go because it doesn't work. I've seen too many people go and come out doing the same thing. Not going to waste my time with that. I got this. I can do it. But I didn't. And so we went to the park and we both screamed and yelled and cried, and he brought me back to this house. And a few minutes later, he called me. Believe it or not, we had a phone at that house. One of the few things we had at that house. And he called me, and he had 5 numbers. And he said, if you call these numbers, these people will help you. and I will be there for you. But you got to do this. So I started down the list, and one place was up in Buffalo Valley, somewhere up in East Tennessee. And they told me, they took my assessment over the phone, and they said, well, you come, and you'll probably need to be here for a year, and you would have to work and give us your money. And I thought, yeah, right, I'll call you back. Call you back, okay? And so I called the second number, and I can't remember. I believe it was Synergy or even Serenity. I'm not sure, but they said kind of the same thing about 9 months, and I told them I'd call them back. And third number was Memphis Recovery Center, and what I heard them say was 3 months. Cool, 3 months, I'll get well. I can come home, take care of my dad, get a job. Everything's going to be just fine. So I called my brother and said, I got to keep calling these people every day until they find a bed. And they called me that following Wednesday, and my brother drove me to Memphis, and we did some more paperwork. And they said, you got to go home and come back on Monday. And I thought, no, man, I got to stay here today. I can't. If I go today, I might not come back. And they said, no, you got to go and come back on Monday. So we went back, and as soon as I got back, you know what I did. I went and found something to drink and something to go with that. But you know what? It still wasn't working. It wasn't working. I tried until Friday, and then on Saturday morning, I got up and said, okay. I started to gather clothes together and pack, and anyway, on Monday morning, I was sitting on the porch waiting for my brother. He drove me to that treatment center, and I had a weird experience the first day there, another God thing. When we walked in and sat down waiting for the counselor, the treatment coordinator to come, they had this sign up there, and it said, rest here. Pain dissolves to peace. Fear fades to hope. And addiction gives way to recovery. And I went, whoa. And my brother says, you see that sign? And he looked at me, and tears were rolling. He said, yeah, you see it. He said, it's going to be all right. Which it did. It was okay. And as he was leaving, they were taking me to the nurse's station to be tested. And they had this door closed to the woman's wing. There was this huge lady, and her face was in the door there. And hair was all over her head, and she was beating on the door. And I turned to my brother, and I said, oh, no, we're in the wrong place. You tricked me. This is a crazy house. No, 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 I don't belong here. And I begged him not to leave me. And thank God there was this kindly treatment coordinator. She said, go on, honey. She'll be all right. And she turned out to be one of my counselors. And true to her word, it was all right. Man, 90 days. I was counting off the days, you know, checking them off. At day 76, they were still like, nah. You know, and you know, for some reason or another, at day 76, I stopped counting the days. I want you guys to know I ended up staying in that treatment center for 1 year and 3 weeks. God had something totally different in store for me. You see, I had other spiritual experiences during that time. You know, I told you that I wanted to get better, go home, take care of my dad, get a job, get our house back. I didn't know how I was going to do all of that stuff. But that was the goal. That was my plan. And they kept telling me that I had a plan, that I had my own treatment plan. And they convinced me to be there in January. I was there 5 months. And I said, you know, if you want me to stay here longer, I need to go see my dad. I got to go see my dad. And they agreed to do that. And that lady was going to take me on that Monday. Well, that Friday before, my brother called and said that our dad was sick, that he had placed him into the hospital. And I said, well, I'm coming home. And he said, well, I understand you're coming Monday. Just wait until Monday. I'll keep you posted. So they were pushing me to get a fifth step done that day. I didn't understand that either. But I got a fifth step done with this temporary sponsor. And that night, we were having a book study. And now my mind was in my hometown, Trenton, Tennessee, where my dad was. And this girl that was sitting beside me, she's still my friend today, and she's still sober today. She pointed for me to read. And when I read, it said, my dad died while I was in treatment. And I remember, to me, the words were raised and bold and sitting off the page, and I froze. And I just froze, and I was like, I think someone finally said, can you finish reading? I think I finished the paragraph. And I was like, God, please, no, don't let my father die. But that Saturday morning, they came and got me out of a group. And my brother was on the phone. And my father had died. And I thought, this is just not right. You know, I'm trying to do the right thing, and I'm trying to get it together, God. Why are you still punishing me? What is this all about? And anyway, they let me go and make funeral arrangements, and I got to see my brothers and other family members. And you know, black families, we hold our people out until everybody comes home. You know, this was on Monday, and we weren't going to bury him until Saturday. And Tuesday morning, they came to me and said, did you get everything taken care of that you needed to do? And I said, yes. You know, all the arrangements have been made. And they said, well, we see no reason why you should go back there. I thought, you got to be crazy. That's my father, you know. What are you talking about? And they were like, if you leave treatment and go home, you can't come back here. Your treatment is over. You need to stay here and do what's necessary for you. And I thought, I need to talk to my brother. I need to talk to him right now. And they let me do that, and he said the same thing that they said. And I thought, he's a lunatic too. Everybody's against me. So I sat and I prayed, and I had this woman who became my sponsor. She, from the first week I was there, she came every Wednesday. She was like clockwork. Y'all know Marion. She was there at that treatment center every Wednesday bringing the message. And she had tried to tell me about God. She had told me about pages 86, 87, and 88. We had big talks about God because she had a problem with God when she got here too. And she was trying to help me with this God concept. She had introduced me to the third step prayer on page 63. And, you know, I kept praying. And I finally said, God, you know, I'm going to do what these people say. But please help me be able to live with this decision. Please help me, because I don't know how I could live with this. And so I continue to participate in the groups and do what they ask of me without complaining. And that was certainly a God thing. And so on Friday at dinner time, we eat every day at 5 o'clock. They came to me and said, if you find somebody in recovery to take you home, you can go. And I'm like, well, who am I going to find at 5 o'clock? The funeral's at 11 o'clock. You know, that's what's going on in my head. But this other little voice said, call Marion. But they kept saying, call your temporary sponsor first. So I did, and she was out of town. She couldn't take me. So I called Marion, and she answered. Marion hardly ever answers her phone on the first ring, right? She did that day. And I told her what, before I could get it all out, she was like, what time do I pick you up? And she took me to that funeral, and she met my family, and she sat with us, and she ate with us, and she was never showed signs of being in a hurry. She never rushed me. And God, I had uncles and aunts that had her ear, man. They were telling her from the time I was like this, and, you know, they just, they had her. And she was... It was just, you know, she probably knew more about my fifth step than I did by the time they got through with her. So anyway, we did that, and we took care of my father, and you know, and I forgot to tell you that prior to his death, I had asked her to be my sponsor. And she had said yes. And when I go to tell my counselor that this woman is going to be my sponsor, they said, well, you can't have her because another girl in treatment has her. You can't share the same sponsor. So I said, okay. And so months later, you know, I mean, when this happens, you know, I'm trying to get up the nerve to ask her, when this girl leaves, will you be my sponsor when she leaves? And on the way back, she pulls the car over real fast, scared me. And she says, do you still want me as your sponsor? And I go, well, yeah. And she said, well, I prayed about this, and I think God means for us to be together. And thus started our journey. And I was like, well, what about the other girl? And she was like, don't worry about that. God's got that. And so when I get back, that girl is gone. She's not even there. Man, Mary knew that, I know. But she's gone. So Marion became my sponsor, and we started working the steps together. And I was 5 months sober. I got a job at this treatment center. They allowed me to go out and work. And by the time I was a year sober, I had gotten an apartment. I had everything that I needed to get started. And they were allowing me to go out on weekends to this apartment and come back through the week I was there and go to work. And it was time for me to pay my second month's stuff. And I celebrated my first birthday at my home group, Unity. And man, these people were so good to me. They were very loving and kind, and I had just gotten this phone, and it was, the voicemail was blown out because so many people had called to wish me a happy birthday. Now, I was in that treatment center for a year, y'all, and I had three outfits, warm-up suits, pink, blue, and gray. And I wore those. And the other girls were getting all these packages from home. And she would say, what do you need? You don't need to ask your brother for anything. You can only wear one outfit at a time. And we got a washer and a dryer, so what do you need? And so the day that I graduated from that treatment center, my sponsor, Marion, came to pick me up. And she had a duffel bag full of brand new clothes. And see, people like Arlene, Shell, all of these ladies, Amanda, different people I know had a hand in that. People, women in my home group put that duffel bag together. When I walked out of there, I had a wardrobe. That's how God first started working in my life. So I met with this woman, and we were working the steps. And you know, when I first looked at the steps, I didn't see how that stuff was going to work. What did that have to do with anything? It did not make sense. I didn't see how any of that was going to change my life. But the more God showed me, the more I became willing. And they said, all you got to do is be honest, open-minded, and willing. These are the three essentials. If you don't have these three things, you won't stay sober. And I had a sponsor that would call me on my honesty. You know, I would tend to omit things. She don't need to know everything. And she would start asking me, pinpointing me. She was good. You know what I'm talking about. She's real good at narrowing things down where you can't wiggle and you can't lie. And so you have to tell. You have to be honest. You have to. And she would say, Mary, you know when you don't tell me something, that's dishonesty. You're not. And I'm like, how am I being this? I mean, I'm being honest. I told, but you left out major details. So I don't do that today. I don't do that today. And you know, it's not too long ago that I made that mistake. And I think I had to call her back and say, Marion, you know, I didn't quite tell you the truth. And I had to tell her the truth. And after what I could do to make it right between us. And I just not do it again. Just don't do it again. And so I got with her and I worked the steps and I watched the ladies in my home group. They showed me what this deal was all about, helping the next alcoholic. I had counselors, and Lynn is one of them and she's here tonight. You know, you got to get in the middle of this thing. You can't be around the edges. Miss Noya used to say, it's like a herd. The ones on the outside get picked off. You got to get in the middle of this deal. And I had a sponsor that threw me out there in the middle of this deal. They were taking me to treatment centers, doing book studies, telling my story. There was a group called Into Action, and they would do 10-minute spot speakers, and they would just call me up and say, look, you need to be ready. Somebody's picking you up at so-and-so, and you're going so-and-so, and you're doing this. And I got, do I have any say in this? And no, just be ready. And that's what I did. And then I was 15 months sober, and Arlene and Marion, I had heard Arlene talking about Mont Eagle. But Marion said, you're going. And I'm like, I don't have money to go there. Did anyone ask you about money? Just be packed and ready to go. And at 15 months sober, I was here at Mont Eagle. And we came on a Thursday night. And I was telling Lynn just the other night, you know, it's funny. I remember the topic the first night I was here. I don't remember any other. You know, but that first night, you read from the big book, page 100. Both you and the new man must walk the path of spiritual progress side by side. And if you persist, remarkable things will happen. And see, that was the passage that Marion had given to me. She had written it in my first meditation book. She had given me a daily reflection, and she wrote that in it. And in big, bold letters, she had written, persist. So that meant something to me. I persist today. I passed it on to the young ladies that I sponsor. You know, you can't rest on your laurels in this thing. This is an everyday, one day at a time process. And you know, the more I'm here and the more I do it, the more fun I have with it. And I want to thank the gentleman in the back because he said to me tonight, he gave me a hug and said, one thing, just get up there and have fun with this. Don't worry about him. And you know, I really appreciated that. You know, but I knew no matter what happens, God has got this thing. I'm just an instrument. And I like being used by God today. I never like being used by people. You see, you can't use me today, not for anything bad. Because anything that you mean bad for me, God turns to good. I've seen that happen too much in this very program. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a member in our home group that says she loves AA, and I do too. I really do. And now it was shortly after I left that treatment center that another miracle happened for me. I remember when I was there, this counselor of mine, she asked me what were two things that would make me not do this anymore. And I said that my father died and if I went to jail. Well, my father died when I was in treatment, right? And you know what? I couldn't have made it through that deal had I not been there. I don't know how. I know God was in the mix with all the decisions that were made. It was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I'm so grateful for that. But upon leaving that treatment center, I left in September. September 6th is when I graduated in 2006. And I guess a few months after I left there, you know, my apartment had been broken into. And let me back up. Marion had started to have me making amends. She said, well, you know, we got to get a lot of, before we start doing, you know, we're just at step four, right? But she said, there's some stuff you got to get straightened out. Some immediate stuff. Like, I knew I had a warrant out for me because I didn't show up in court when I went to treatment. So when you don't show up, they issue a bench warrant, right? And I knew that. But see, I got to save some money, and then I'll take them all this money, and they'll leave me alone. And she said, no, you're going to call them. You're going to tell them where you are, how much money you're making, where you're working, and what you can do each week. And if they accept that, fine. If they don't accept it, then you'll do whatever it is they want you to do. And I go, no, they want me to go to jail. She goes, if that's what they want, then that's what you'll do. And I'm like, yeah. So, you know, I sat on that for a couple of days. But I called them. I did call them. And I gave them the same script that she ran down to me. And you know what they did? They cut my fines in half, said, if you don't miss a payment, we won't come get you. But if you miss a payment, we'll come find you. And once you made all these payments, we will withdraw the warrant. No problem. I'm not getting in any trouble, and I'm going to send you your money every week because you agreed, and you cut the fines in half. So I'm about three of them. Exactly, $372.50. That's going to be my final two payments, right? I'm split. I'm down to the end, and my apartment gets broken into, and my landlord calls and says, you have to come home and call the police because we can't go into the apartment until you're there with the police. And I'm going, no. I'm like, oh, God. Now, so I'm calling my sponsor, and I can't get her. So I call my best friend. I can't get her. And I'm on the bus, and I'm trying to get home, and I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I need to talk to somebody, and nobody is answering their phone. So when I get there, and I live in a gated area, the police is there, and I let him in, and we go to my apartment. And sure enough, the landlord, they come, and they're fixing the door and the windows where this person broke in. And this guy, tall black cop, handsome, was making the report and doing all of this stuff and talking to me. And you know, these people destroyed my apartment. And I was trying to pick up all my AA books and meditation. And Arlene had given me a bracelet. I get a bracelet every year for my birthday. And she had given me this bracelet that said, be still and know that I am God. And I was looking for that bracelet. It was my first year bracelet. And they took it. I couldn't find it. They had thrown jewelry. They knew the good stuff. They picked all the good stuff out and left the track, you know, the costume stuff. And I couldn't find it. He goes, what are you looking for? And I said, I'm looking for my bracelet. And he said, what are all those books? And I was telling him, and he stood up and he said, you know, he said, all of this sounds, because I was talking about AA, and he was like, you know, this sounds really good. He said, but Miss Rogers, I'm really sorry. He put his hands on his handcuffs and he pulled them and he says, I'm gonna have to take you to jail. And I said, I know. So what do you mean you know? So I started to tell him how I knew. And I thought, well, this is weird. Policemen don't talk to me. They just put the handcuffs on and haul you on off, right? But, you know, y'all ever had several voices in your head all at one time? I had these voices going, run, run, run. There's the door, hit the door, hit the door, run, run, run. And this other voice is saying, just be still, let's see what he's talking about. Forget what he's talking about, you gotta go, all of this stuff is going on. And where's Marion, why isn't she calling me? Why can't I talk to anybody? Oh, will you just shut up? And he's like, what's wrong with you? And I go, oh, nothing. And he was like, well, can you get this woman on the phone? And I go, well, sure I can. And I was like, God, please let her answer. Please let her answer. And Wilma, her assistant, answered the phone. And I told her who I was and what was going on. And she said, well, hold on. And so she went and got Brenda. And Brenda came to the phone. And I told Brenda. And she was like, let me talk to this cop, she says. Handing the phone. And he said, look, lady, he said, you know, I don't want to take this woman to jail. He said, because she seems like a nice lady and da-da-da. He said, but if this goes back out on the wire, he said, I'm going to have to take her. And he was like, okay. So he gives me the phone back, and Brenda says to me, Mary, be still. Okay, that's God. He's telling me to be still. And by this time, Marion is calling, and he won't let me talk to her. My best friend is calling, and he won't let me talk to her. And he said, just tell him you'll call him back. And I said, Marion, I hang up. Marion's still trying to talk, and I hang up on her. And so he's talking to me, and we're talking about AA, and he's telling me about drug addicts who robbed him. And he said, you know a drug addict broke into your house? And I said, yeah, I pretty much know that, you know. Tell me something. He's talking all that crap, and I'm worried about going to jail. But at the same time, these voices are saying, God didn't bring you this far to drop you off. And they've already told you, if you go to jail, so what? You can still stay sober. You had nothing when you got here. Whatever you lose, God can replace 10 times. What are you afraid of? And he said, why don't you call that lady back? And I started to try to call her, and she was calling me. And she said, give the officer the phone. And I heard him say, are you sure? Are you sure? Are you sure? And he hands me the phone, and she was like, Mary, call me later. And I was like, well, wait a minute, what I'm trying to find? And I turned to him, and he's got this little iPod-like thing, and there's my last picture when I was in jail. And beneath it was flashing, no warrants. No warrants. And I was like, and this big guy stands up, and he hugs me, and he says, keep doing what you've been doing. And he leaves. And by this time, he's going out the back door. Marion and Sonia are knocking on the front door. And I let them in. And I had also called my brother Johnny in the process of all this. And you know, the funny thing, when I was telling him what had happened while Marion and Sonia were sitting there, you know, he said the strangest thing. He said, all you've done is added to your story. He's not an alcoholic. I was like, so those are the kinds. You guys, I could tell y'all more and more stories like this that happened in my life. God blesses me all the time. Michelle was telling somebody last night that when I got here, I didn't have much hair. I cut my hair off in a drunken rage. And I didn't have any front teeth. And you know, God has just truly blessed me in this deal. Not by material riches. You know, those things meant a lot to me prior to getting here. You know, I had to have the right job, make the right money, have the right kind of house or apartment, drive the right kind of car. You know, I was in this deal 4 years riding the bus. Prior to coming here, I ride a bus? What are you talking about? But I felt like I had used my rights up to have a car. You know, I had the money to get a car. People just say, why don't you buy you a car? When I get a car, I'll know it. God will make it available to me. And he did just that. So I wait for God today rather than waiting on Mary. I love the saying that says, trust finite God rather than in my infinite self. Did I say that right? You know what I meant. I probably didn't say it right, but I want to end this with my favorite quote. In that treatment center that I was in, when you finish their program, you get a certificate or coin, and you get to paint a brick. Halfway through that deal, that was very important to me, because for the last few years, I'd never been able to finish anything that I started. And I felt like if I did that I had a chance, because I still wasn't sure about this AA stuff. It looked good on y'all, it sounded good, but I just didn't know. And I read this book, and there was this one guy that used to tell me that you got to study it like a textbook. And Marion just always impressed me with, no matter what problem I had, she could go to the book and show it to me. And I try to do the same with my sponsees today. It's not about what Mary says. It's about what the book says. It's about what Mary does today, not what I say. But this is the statement that I wrote on my brick. And I'm going to read something prior to that, but I'll tell you when I get to the brick part. But I love this passage. It says, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. And this is what I put on my brick. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Now, I love this. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless and keep you until then. And, you know, I thought trudging, you know, I would ask my sponsor, trudge, what does that truly mean? Because I thought it meant hardship and that I was going to be struggling. And she said, no, darling, it means you walk with a purpose today. And I truly feel that I walk with a purpose today, and I try to show that to everybody that I come into contact with, especially the people I sponsor and other women that I try to help. You said that I had to give away what was so freely given to me. I can't keep it unless I give it away. So I'll give you everything today because I want to keep what I have. God has truly, truly blessed me. And I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous and for all of you. Thank you.